In NPR's business report, the UAW and auto parts supplier Visteon have reached an agreement on a 7-year contract. The new deal is a supplement to the 2003 national agreement with Ford. Detroit Public Radio's Celeste Headley reports.
Visteon is the largest parts supplier for Ford Motor Company. The 2003 national contract was ratified by UAW members at Ford and Visteon in October. Now the two sides have signed a supplement that covers wages and benefits for future hires at Visteon's 15 UAW shops in the U.S. Under the new contract, new hires will be paid far less than current employees. From now on, starting wages will be $14 an hour, and employees can earn up to $18.50. Current employees at Visteon make about $24 an hour. Future workers will also have to bear a larger portion of health care costs. The UAW reached a similar agreement with Delphi, the largest parts supplier for General Motors. Union officials say the new agreements will help Visteon and Delphi remain competitive. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Headley in Detroit.
American Airlines has announced that because of higher fuel costs, it is increasing its domestic fares $2 each way. The increase is effective immediately. The air carrier says crude oil prices at nearly $40 a barrel, the highest price since 1990, have caused significant increases in the cost of jet fuel. American also says each 1 cent rise in the price of a gallon of jet fuel costs the airline more than $30 million per year. Several major U.S. carriers, including American, tried to raise round-trip fares in early March, but retreated when Northwest Airlines refused to go along. American's parent company, AMR Corporation, announced last week that it lost $177 million in the first 3 months of the year. It blamed about half the loss on higher prices for jet fuel. Pixar beat Wall Street's expectations in its January through March earnings report. The animation studio benefited from better-than-expected revenues from the home video market. Jason Lopez reports from San Francisco.
Pixar's Finding Nemo continues to generate significant income. It was released on May 30th last year. According to the company, the movie is the 8th best-selling film of all time, having sold $863 million in tickets at the box office. In the first 3 months of the year, Pixar earned $26 million, 3 times what it earned a year ago. Revenue came in at $53 million, again, about 3 times more than in the year-ago quarter. Pixar owes Disney 2 more movies to complete their distribution agreement. Disney keeps half of the revenue from Pixar films, but CEO Steve Jobs says that by finding another distributor, Pixar's revenues would essentially double. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
Negotiators for SBC Communications and the Communications Workers of America are still trying to reach a new contract agreement before tomorrow's strike deadline. Talks between the two sides are taking place in Washington. A federal mediator is overseeing the talks and is asking that the two sides intensify their efforts to avoid a walkout. Yet to be resolved are disagreements over wages, job security, health care, and pensions for more than 100,000 workers in 13 states. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld testifies before Congress about the abuse of Iraqi prisoners in U.S. custody. His appearance comes one day after President Bush apologized and the House condemned the incidents in a resolution. But some lawmakers want something more than a resolution. They want Rumsfeld's resignation, NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The House resolution is an attempt to show the world that the U.S. Congress deplores the mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners. House Republican leader Tom DeLay said the perpetrators must be dealt with swiftly and fully.
Our government has a responsibility to find out exactly what happened, what went wrong, and make sure it never happens again.
The resolution was also an attempt by Republicans to contain the storm of anger sweeping over Capitol Hill. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi seethed over the fact that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld came to the Capitol last week to brief lawmakers on Iraq and didn't say a word about the story and the photos that were soon to be broadcast.
He neglected to tell members of Congress that the situation in Iraq included this most unfortunate, disgraceful situation in the prison. He withheld that information from the Congress of the United States when he had full knowledge of it, and apparently had full knowledge for a while.
That charge of deliberately withholding information from Congress and perhaps the White House has fueled fiery demands for Rumsfeld's resignation from Democrats. They are sure to ask him about that today. Arizona Republican Senator John McCain is also looking to this hearing with Rumsfeld to clarify the details of the scandal.
We've got to get this issue resolved to the satisfaction of the American people so that we can focus all our attention on the enormous crisis that exists in Iraq today. We are in a very critical time.
McCain said now more than ever, the U.S. must hold to the June 30th deadline for the transition of sovereignty from the U.S. to Iraq. The Senate as a whole gave its assent to this priority yesterday in an overwhelming vote of 95-3, confirming U.N. Ambassador John Negroponte as the new U.S. ambassador to Iraq after the transition. And though he's angry, McCain has not called for Rumsfeld's resignation, saying that would be premature. But he and the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, Pennsylvania's John Murtha, agreed on one thing they'd like to tell Rumsfeld during his questioning today, that it is irresponsible for the U.S. to continue using the Abu Ghraib prison. It was a notorious torture facility under Saddam Hussein, and now it is, as McCain puts it, a place of shame for Americans. House Democrat Murtha, a Marine in both the Korean and Vietnam Wars, echoed that sentiment.
They ought to close that prison. They ought to burn that prison. They ought to destroy that prison is what they ought to do. That's the first step they ought to do. That would impress the Arab world. We're serious. This is the most notorious prison probably in the world, except for maybe Dachau and some of the concentration camps. It should be destroyed.
As yet, no Republican has called for Rumsfeld to resign. But today's hearings in the House and Senate Armed Services Committees will help determine whether the furor over prisoner abuse dies down or continues to grow in the days ahead. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
Secretary Rumsfeld has said that anyone responsible for abusing Iraqi prisoners will be brought to justice. So far, six soldiers have been severely reprimanded, while six more face courts-martial. But no civilian contractors have been disciplined, and NPR's Jackie Northam reports the contractors fall into a legal vacuum.
The 53-page Army report gives precise details about the abuses Iraqi prisoners suffered and who was responsible for them. Sprinkled among the military generals and colonels are the names of civilian contractors who were at the prison. The report describes some of them as witnesses, one simply as a suspect. Two other civilian contractors are alleged to have been directly or indirectly involved in the abuses. One of them works for the San Diego-based Titan Corporation, the other for the Arlington, Virginia-based CACI International. During a conference call with investors earlier this week, Jack London, the president of CACI, talked about the report.
We have not received any information to stop any of our work, to terminate or suspend any of our employees, and if we're asked to participate in any investigations by the United States federal government, you must be assured we will fully cooperate.
But so far, both companies say they have not been approached by the Pentagon, even though the Army report recommends the CACI employee be fired and the Titan worker reprimanded. But legal experts say if the civilian contractors took part in the abuse, the courts, rather than the companies, should deal with them. Harold Coe is a professor of international law at Yale Law School. He says if the allegations are true, then there are a number of things with which the contractors can be charged.
I think they could be charged with both these international offenses, violations of the Geneva Conventions, grave breaches, as well as violations of the torture treaty and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, as well as various domestic crimes.
Gary Solis, a professor of law at Georgetown University and an expert on the laws of war, says if the violations of law prove true, the question is what court can the civilian contractors be turned over to? Military personnel would likely be tried under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Concerning the contractors, Solis says a section of the code would appear to give jurisdiction to the military.
But our experience in Vietnam, where we tried a few civilians, indicates otherwise. In each of those cases that involve civilians from the Vietnam era, their convictions were reversed either by military appellate courts or, in one case, by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Civil courts in Iraq would be another option. However, there's a policy that Americans cannot be tried in Iraqi courts. Peter Singer is a national security fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says there's talk about whether there's a way around that policy.
This is one of these things where you get into a legal jurist debate over, for example, does former local civil law trump any law that the occupation authority tries to put down?
The other option is America's federal courts. Singer says there's only one statute in the U.S. that applies to the contractor role, and that's the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, known as MEJA. It was passed by Congress in 2000. Professor Solis says it was drawn up as a way to address civilians, such as the contractors, who accompany the military in the field. The Act says those civilians can be tried in federal courts, but Solis says MEJA has never been tested.
In other words, Congress has passed the Act subject to DOD saying in detail how it will be done, how U.S. Marshals will pick up individuals, who will hold these civilian individuals, which court in the United States they will be transferred to. And after 4 years, DOD still is many months away from completing the implementing instructions.
Solis says until the Department of Defense draws up those instructions, things are at a standstill. And Attorney General John Ashcroft yesterday said he won't be interfering with the Pentagon right now.
I do know that the Department of Defense is involved in a substantial investigation, and that it certainly wouldn't be our intention to disrupt investigations underway by the Department of Defense.
There are an estimated 20,000 contract workers in Iraq. The prison abuse scandal may quicken the pace for setting up a legal framework under which the civilians can be prosecuted. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
The time is 19 minutes past the hour.
Exhibit A, the Red Sox fan.
This is the most important game in the destiny and the future of the Boston Red Sox. And you know what? It's killing me. I've been sick all week. I haven't gone to work since Monday.
And there are lots more where he comes from. A filmmaker's documentary about Red Sox fans. It's called Still, We Believe. Later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
Thank you.
On Monday, there will be a presidential election in the Philippines, pitting the incumbent Gloria Macapagal-Arroyo against a man who has never held public office. Fernando Po Jr. is a movie star known across the Philippines by his initials, FPJ. He wants to follow the example of another Filipino actor who became president, Joseph Estrada. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Manila.
Fernando Po Jr. is used to playing the underdog. In fact, he's made a career of it, literally, in scores of action films. The plots of most follow the same basic formula, Po fighting for the little people against impossible odds, as in this 1964 film, The Walls of Hell. In it, Po plays a Filipino guerrilla battling the Japanese occupation during World War II.
There is a bombed-out building in Muralla Street where the Japanese are holding about 1,000 civilians. Men, women, and children. And if things get any tougher in there, they're going to be massacred. I'm going to get them out.
Po is huge here, the Filipino equivalent of John Wayne and Arnold Schwarzenegger rolled into one. His movies are so popular and Po so prolific that he is known here as Da King, or simply by his initials, FPJ. Political analyst Joel Rocamora says there is little or no difference between Po the man and the characters he plays, which is part of his appeal.
He really is a shy person. And it's no accident that his movie persona is like an archetype. Shane, High Noon type of character who rolls into town, shoots them up, and then leaves. And nobody knows where he came from, where he goes. He's a loner.
It's that persona that's made him so popular at the box office, and popular now with many voters, even though he's never held elected office, and dropped out of school in the eighth grade. Analyst Rocamora says Po, a close friend of former President Estrada, was persuaded to enter politics by Estrada's friends and by former Marcos supporters who see President Arroyo as the enemy, and as someone who has done little to improve the economy, end rampant corruption, or bring an end to several rebel insurgencies.
So what the politicians did was to persuade him that the movie character Fernando Po, who is a savior, should become the savior for this whole rotten, corrupt, elite-dominated country. And he believed them.
Poe's entertainment roots are reflected in his rallies, like this one, which kicked off his campaign. Thousands of exuberant Poe supporters entertained by the popular all-girl group the Sex Bomb Dancers, who gyrated on stage to the delight of many in the audience. Po, in keeping with his on-screen character, is a man of few words at these rallies. His speeches rarely last for more than 2 or 3 minutes, but his words resonate with Filipino voters unhappy with what they perceive as a corrupt political culture.
First of all, we must bring back the trust and confidence in our government. We must have a leadership that will apply the rule of law and total transparency.
Critics, however, complain that Poe's performances and platform are short on substance, that he has been unable to articulate his vision, how he plans to create better government more responsive to the needs of the people, but that criticism falls on deaf ears among many poor who make up the vast majority of the electorate and the vast majority of those who swept Poe's friend Joseph Estrada to power 6 years ago. This is Payatas, a large Metro Manila slum that voted overwhelmingly for Joseph Estrada in 1998, and a place where support for his good friend Fernando Po Jr. runs high. The houses here are flimsy affairs, many of them just wooden shacks, the streets often just dirt paths, and the water, where available, is drawn from wells. 47-year-old Minda Mangampo makes a living here selling fish.
I will vote for FPJ. Why? Because I like him. No record, no bad record in the government. Even though he has a low education, I don't care. But still, I believe that he can manage the government to be good for all the people because he's innocent.
He's innocent?
He's innocent about the corruption.
One of her neighbors, a kitchenware salesman named Alan Arcega, says FPJ, like Estrada, is pro-poor and will help people like him.
Kasi ma'am, lahat kasi ng ano nung ng kandidato natin ngayon, ano no?
All the candidates, all the other candidates now are traditional politicians who have held various public positions, but they have not improved our lot. They have not done good for us. I believe FPJ will be able to do good for all of us because he has a good heart.
But a good heart, former bus driver Melchor Luistro says, isn't enough. He is one of the few people in the neighborhood who says he will support the incumbent, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. Experience and education, the driver says, is what matters, and Fernando Poe Jr., he says, has neither.
There is no question about his character. He's a good man, but the problem is he didn't even finish high school, so how will he run government? He will just depend on advisors, and what if the advisors he chooses are corrupt?
Then, as he finishes, the man reaches into his back pocket and pulls out his wallet. He opens it up and takes out a photo of Fernando Poe Jr. Everyone laughs. The man smiles apologetically. FPJ is a good man, he says. I just don't think he should be president, because then corrupt people will just bring him down. The former bus driver may not have to worry. After spending months as the front runner, Fernando Poe Jr. has now fallen behind President Arroyo in recent polls. Analysts say this is due to an aggressive and smartly managed campaign by President Arroyo and a poorly organized Poe campaign. Poe supporters, however, say their candidate can still come from behind to win, just like he's done hundreds of times before on the big screen. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Manila.
It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Support for NPR comes from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage, from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation for support of the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media, from the Lois Pope Life Foundation, working to create a memorial for disabled veterans in Washington, D.C., at life-edu.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working toward an America in which all have health coverage, on the web at covertheuninsuredweek.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And this is AM 580 WILL Urbana, public radio from the campus of the University of Illinois. In just a moment here, we'll be going to National Public Radio for live coverage of hearings today before the Senate Armed Services Committee, scheduled to testify the Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld and General Richard Myers, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We expect this will take the rest of the morning and continue past noon. At some point, we'll get back on our regular schedule with the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn. Time now is 10:30.
This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. The next few hours will bring you live coverage of the testimony of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and General Richard Myers, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, at the Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington. This hearing was called to question Rumsfeld and Myers about the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by members of the American military. It comes amid pressure on Rumsfeld to resign from Democrats on the Hill and the media editorials. Republican leaders have expressed concern, but not yet to the point of demanding a resignation. Virginia Senator John Warner is the chair of the Armed Services Committee. He said Rumsfeld should have told Congress about the abuses earlier. But in a broadcast interview this morning, Warner said it's too early to say whether the abuse of prisoners was an isolated incident at Baghdad's notorious Abu Ghraib prison or systematic in many facilities. President Bush is standing by his defense secretary, though he too criticized Rumsfeld for not telling the White House earlier. Senate Armed Services Committee hearing is scheduled to start in about 15 minutes. We'll bring you that hearing in its entirety. Joining me here in our studio is Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, and Mary Louise Kelly, NPR's intelligence correspondent. Ron, how did these hearings come about?
These hearings came about rather quickly toward the end of this week in response to the Senate Armed Services Committee's great urgent demand to speak to the secretary and speak to him in public. In other words, show the public themselves as the ones asking the questions, not just having a private session with him. On a more obvious sort of level, this burgeoning scandal has put an enormous amount of pressure on the members of Congress. Therefore, they want to put that pressure over onto the head civilian in charge of the Pentagon, the man who is theoretically responsible for everything that goes on in our military, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere. They want to put the responsibility on him. Now, something a little less obvious that's going on here is that members of Congress in the Senate and House feel they've been stiffed by the secretary. He has come and spoken to them in recent weeks and months about the operations in Iraq, and he has not told them anything about these ongoing investigations, anything about these problems, which apparently, according to the International Red Cross, had been called to the attention of the Pentagon as long ago as a year. And they feel as though they've been hung out to dry. They're quite upset about that.
And NPR's congressional correspondent David Wellner is on the Hill right now. David, what are you hearing about the intensity of that dissatisfaction and unhappiness on the Republican side? Certainly we've heard from Democrats. Nancy Pelosi over in the House has called for his resignation. John Kerry, the Democratic presidential hopeful, called for Rumsfeld's resignation. Republicans haven't gone there yet, but what are they saying?
Well, Republicans are leaving the door open to more harsh rebukes of Rumsfeld. They're saying that they're still with Rumsfeld staying on, but they're qualifying those remarks saying that they are for now, or they haven't decided yet that he should resign. I spoke with a Republican Senate aide this morning who said that there's real anger about the undermining of the war effort that has resulted, in their view, from this Abu Ghraib prison scandal.
Mary Louise Kelly, we've heard the president has gone on a couple of Arabic television networks and apologized. To date, the Secretary of Defense has not. What are you hearing about the possibility that he might?
It appears that he will. That's what aides from the Pentagon are telling us this morning. They're saying that he will apologize to Congress for not keeping Congress informed, as we heard that's something that people on the Hill are very upset about. And he's also expected, we're told, to call for the formation of an independent commission to look into not just the abuses at Abu Ghraib, but also how the Defense Department handled them. So that would be an inquiry above and beyond what is already going on in the Pentagon, looking into what happened. It's very crucial that he make a good impression today. There are obviously, as we've heard already, calls for his resignation. Representative Charlie Rangel, Democrat from New York, calling, saying, look, if he doesn't resign and if the president doesn't want to force him to step down, we could impeach him. Now, whether that will ever gain any traction in a Republican-controlled Congress, we don't know. But certainly it's very critical that he make a good impression today.
Well, Ron Elving, how do you do that? What are the Republicans are saying they're going to wait and see. What is it that they could hear or see that would cause them to say Rumsfeld should keep his job?
The secretary has indicated that there is a rational explanation. That's the phrase that we've heard, that he has told the president there is a rational explanation for everything that has happened, including presumably some of the activities we've seen in these photographs. And I really don't think you can overemphasize the importance of the photographs that have been seen on television and in newspapers all over the world, particularly in the Muslim world, the Arab world. I don't think you can overstate how much that's had an impact. And the secretary says there's an explanation for all of this, that this can be put in a context that will make it seem much less inflammatory, that we can tell a better story than we may have told up to now in the Arab world, and make all of this more palatable for the people who do want to be our allies there, and reduce whatever negative effect this is having on the safety of our troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere.
David Wellner, do you think the Republicans on the Hill are expecting an apology at this hearing today?
They say that they got word last night that one of the news items from this testimony today would be that Rumsfeld will offer an apology for not having kept Congress better informed about all of this, and that he would also be announcing the formation of a commission made up of non-Defense Department personnel that would report to him. this Republican Senate aide who told me about this said that this was greeted by derisive laughter, saying that, of course, they expected him to apologize. What else was he going to do? And that it all came was too little, too late, and that the damage has already been done. So it looks like the kind of peace offering that Rumsfeld plans to take to this hearing may not be enough to placate them.
Well, and as both of your answers suggest here, we're dealing with two separate issues. There's the issue of what happened and how much supervision and oversight was taking place in Iraq, and then there's whether or not Congress should have known about this at the same time the Secretary of Defense did.
I certainly don't mean to suggest that the members of Congress are not focused on the substance here. I mean, we have, among other things, and in addition to the photographs, more than two dozen people who have died in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, some of those died of natural causes. Some of them, it's not clear how they died. But there have also been a few cases that have already been ruled homicides of one kind or another. And these were people who were in our custody. There are real damages here. There are real injuries. It is, however, being driven by a perception issue, a political issue. And when we get into that territory, that's where Congress really lives. I mean, they would be handling this in one way if there were investigations they were satisfied with going forward. But they're handling it in the way they are because this has become so much of a worldwide tumult, and they're responding to that as well.
We'll hear from General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What are we likely to hear from him? What is Congress interested in hearing from General Myers? Mary Louise?
Well, General Myers, as you say, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, so if you're trying to examine issues of accountability and where the buck should stop, he certainly is very senior in the command chain. And it'll be interesting to hear sort of how he goes about defending the Pentagon, which is what we would certainly expect him to be doing this morning. As of last Sunday, he admitted that he had not read the official Army report into abuses at Abu Ghraib. This is the now famous Tagubo report that we have heard so much about that documents what was going on there. We should also point out that Secretary Rumsfeld, as recently as Wednesday, admitted that he still had not read the entire report. So I think Congress is really looking to both of these men to sort of find out whether they seem to have a sense of the seriousness of the gravity of the charges that are out there and a sense of proceeding and how they want to go forward in terms of correcting them.
And then, Ron Elving, you're a veteran at sort of covering and watching these things unfold. The story is beginning to cascade in the way we've seen other great stories in the past cascade. Now we're hearing from the Red Cross. They had informed the American military more than a year ago about the possibility of these abuses.
Stories of this kind obviously take on a life of their own. That's a neutral way to describe it. Others would call what's going on this week a media frenzy. There have been those who have raised the objection that, in some measure, all of this media attention is overblown. But I think we have the words of the President of the United States himself and all the other people at the top of the military structure to suggest just how seriously it's being taken now.
Yeah, just to bring us up to date a little bit, too, right now there are more than 30 investigations into misconduct going on right now. 16 months, that's over the past 16 months. 10 cases of suspicious deaths, 10 cases of abuse, are being investigated, and so far less than 5 dishonorable discharges. What else do we know about precisely what has happened to date? Most of the disciplinary actions have been specifically related to the Abu Ghraib prison.
Well, that's a lot of what we're going to hear in terms of as these investigations one by one come out and hopefully are made public in terms of what they find. As Ron mentioned, there are now 25 documented cases of deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past year and a half or so, many of which are still under investigation in terms of what actually happened. I think some of what we're going to be hearing this morning and what they're going to be trying to get at the bottom of is how widespread this is. There were hopes when this first became public that it was an isolated incident. As day by day after day has passed and revelations have come out of possible abuse at perhaps the Guantanamo Bay facilities in Cuba, of documented abuses at Bagram Air Force Base, which is now under U.S. forces where we're keeping detainees in Afghanistan, they'll be looking at whether a culture was created, that after September 11th there was a sense that perhaps anything goes as long as the ends justify the means, and perhaps if interrogations perhaps cross the line a little bit, is that somehow justified if it perhaps prevents a future terrorist attack?
Also questions in Afghanistan, as you suggested, about whether or not the CIA had even listed all of the prisoners it had, so that when Red Cross and other agencies came by, there were people who weren't on list and were being perhaps concealed.
And that's an entirely separate arena that we probably won't get too much more insight into this morning. What we'll hear about this morning is what was going on under military police, military intelligence. This is something that's under the Department of Defense. The CIA, as you say, also operates holding facilities. It conducts interrogations. Has agents in Iraq and Afghanistan, and there's a lot of questions about how procedures have been handled there as well.
Ron Elving, what's the role of the vice president at this stage?
Well, the vice president has been conspicuous by his lack of conspicuousness in recent days, and that oftentimes means that he is in the thick of things, not serving in his public role, but in his role as one of the president's most trusted intimate advisors. An interesting sidelight here, his early time in Washington back all the way to the 1960s, his career has been intertwined with Donald Rumsfeld. When Donald Rumsfeld was a member of Congress, Dick Cheney was a congressional fellow. Working with members of Congress such as Don Rumsfeld. And later when Rumsfeld went into the administration, so did Dick Cheney. So their careers really go back more than three decades in Washington.
And the president himself has a reputation for loyalty with his staff, but he has, you know, we've seen reports now that the president has been upset with the secretary. What's his reaction to all of this at this point?
I think at this point the president wants very badly to keep his inner circle team together. And under even great strains such as these and all the pressure he has, that's what he wants to do. I think that's what Dick Cheney is probably urging him to do, that they will tough this one out, that they will show the rational explanation, and that people will give them the benefit of the doubt.
I think it is interesting just to jump in here, too, in terms of setting the scene for what we're going to see this morning, just how much has changed in a year. 1 year ago, Donald Rumsfeld was the man of the hour. He was, as the New York Times described him today, he was the sort of master tactician behind all this. And these were the days when we saw the president strutting around on an aircraft carrier. It was the days of mission accomplished. And now here he is battling for his political survival in front of the Senate this morning.
Important to note, there's a lot of internal struggle within the White House about what the future of Donald Rumsfeld ought to be. There are those who think he should go and those who think he should stay.
David Wellner?
Yes. I was just going to add to what Mary Louise was saying, that actually Rumsfeld is going almost full circle here in that he started out with a very rocky relationship with Congress in the first months of the Bush administration, and he was seen as being contemptuous of Congress. They felt like he wasn't providing the answers that they wanted from him, and that, in fact, he was giving them far too little information then. And then two wars were fought. There were complaints about the amount of information getting to Congress about what was going on in those wars, but those complaints were fairly muted. Now they've become full-blown again, and you hear both Republicans and Democrats saying that much more has to be learned from the Pentagon if Congress is going to have any role of oversight. And one comment I heard from the vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller, the other day was, well, how can we have oversight if they don't tell us what they're doing?
Well, what you're saying is that in many ways his strength has been his weakness. It's a sense of confidence and bearing that he brings to the job. And when there was perhaps less public support for the administration and what it was doing, he received a lot of criticism from the Hill. When the war began and the run-up to the war, apparently that's when all of that confidence was playing much better and a little less flack from Congress.
Yes, I think that confidence might have been called arrogance initially, and then it mutated into a full-blown sense of command, and now once again it's being seen as arrogance.
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld has entered the hearing room at the Dirksen Senate Office Building along with the chairman of the committee, John Warner. General Myers has also entered the room, and we expect this hearing to begin fairly promptly and move according to schedule, because these two gentlemen then have to move across the hall and meet with the House Armed Services Committee as well. Can we expect, is the, David, pretty much the same sentiment on the House side as we're likely to see on the Senate?
Yes, it's quite the same sentiment. In fact, many of the criticisms coming from Democrats are matching those coming from Republicans. And I think that you may see a bit more flashy rhetoric on the House side. House members often tend to feel a little less inhibited about speaking their minds. The Senate is sometimes more reserved, but it's hard telling. We've got some Democrats on the Senate Armed Services Committee, Ted Kennedy and Robert Byrd, among them, who have never bitten their tongues about speaking out about how they feel about Rumsfeld and about how they feel about the war in Iraq, which they oppose deeply.
Secretary has taken his place now at the witness table, and the members of the Senate Armed Services Committee have approached the dais. One of the members of this committee is... I just want to see if they're about to get started. It will be interesting to see, Ron Elving, any speculation about whether or not the Secretary will maintain that posture of the confident, sometimes arrogant Secretary of State, or will he have to be more humble under these circumstances?
I think we will hear some show of humility, but I think he would not be Donald Rumsfeld if he were not sure of himself.
John Warner is the chairman of the committee. He's a Republican from Virginia.
The first of a series of hearings to receive testimony regarding the mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners by some, I repeat, some elements and certain personnel of the armed forces of the United States, in violation of U.S. and international laws. Testifying before us today is the Secretary of Defense, the Honorable Donald Rumsfeld. He is joined by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, Acting Secretary of the Army, Les Brownlee, Army Chief of Staff, General Peter Schoonmaker, and Central Command Deputy Commander, Lieutenant General Lance Smith. We welcome each of you today. I've had the privilege of being associated with, and more importantly, learning from, the men and women of the armed forces for close to 60 years of my life. And I can say that the facts that I now have from a number of sources represent to me as serious an issue of military misconduct as I have ever observed. These reports could also seriously affect this country's relationships with other nations, the conduct of the war against terrorism, and place in jeopardy the men and women of the armed forces wherever they are serving in the world. This mistreatment of prisoners represents an appalling and totally unacceptable breach of military regulations and conduct. Most significant, the replaying of these images day after day throughout the Middle East, and indeed the world, has the potential to undermine the substantial gains, emphasize the substantial gains towards the goal of peace and freedom in various operation areas of the world, most particularly Iraq, and the substantial sacrifice by our forces, and those of our allies, in the war on terror. Let me be as clear as one senator can be. This is not the way for anyone who wears the uniform of the United States of America to conduct themselves. This degree of breakdown in military leadership and discipline represents an extremely rare, and I repeat, rare chapter in the otherwise proud history of the armed forces of the United States. It defies common sense. It contradicts all the values we Americans learn, beginning in our homes. Members of the committee, as we conduct this hearing, I urge you that we take every care that our actions, our words, our individual and collective conduct in this hearing not reflect unfairly on the 99.9% of our uniformed personnel who are performing remarkable tasks and in some cases making the ultimate sacrifice of life and limb to win the war on terror. Each of us on the committee has nothing but the strongest support for our brave men and women in uniform and their families, and what we seek through this and following hearings is to find out for the American people, is only to strengthen and honor their efforts, not in any way to detract from them and their accomplishments. I would point out that while some systems have failed, we are here today because of a courageous enlisted man and his lieutenant whose values, American values, compel them to step forward and inform their superiors. They did the right thing. And as this committee performs its constitutional duties and hearings and oversight, we are working in the same spirit as those two soldiers. Questions before us today are, who knew what and when? What did they do about it? And why were members of Congress not properly and adequately informed? My 25 years on this committee, I've received hundreds of calls day and night from top and all levels, uniform and civilian, from the Department of Defense when they, in their judgment, felt it was necessary. And I dare say other members on this committee have experienced the same courtesy. I did not receive such a call in this case, and yet I think the situation was absolutely clear and required it, not only to me, but my distinguished ranking member and other members of this committee. Members of the committee, our central task here today is to get all the facts in this difficult situation, no matter where they lead, no matter how embarrassing they may be, so that we can assess our response and in the end make sure that such dereliction of duty as is in this case never, never happens again in the proud history of our country. Senator Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The abuses that were committed against
Carl Levin is a Democrat from Michigan.
Custody at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq dishonored our military and our nation, and they made the prospects for success in Iraq even more difficult than they already are. Our troops are less secure, and our nation is less secure because these depraved and despicable actions will fuel the hatred and the fury of those who oppose us. General Tacuba's investigation, as reported, paints an alarming picture of abuse and humiliation of Iraqi prisoners. It has enraged people here at home and throughout the civilized world. Humiliating and sexually abusing prisoners has nothing to do with the effective internment or interrogation of prisoners. In fact, such actions are counterproductive to those goals. As we seek to bring stability and democracy to Iraq and to fight terrorism globally, our greatest asset as a nation is the moral values that we stand for. Those values have been compromised. To begin the process of restoring them, the people involved who carried out or who authorized or suggested that we should, quote, loosen prisoners up, or, quote, make sure they get the treatment, must be held accountable. So must anyone up the chain of command be held accountable, who had command responsibility over the interrogation and security of prisoners, and who knew or should have known of these abuses and looked the other way. General Taguba's finding that, quote, personnel assigned to the 372nd MP Company were directed to change facility procedures to set the conditions for military intelligence interrogations is bolstered by pictures that suggest that the sadistic abuse was part of an organized and conscious process of intelligence gathering. In other words, those abusive actions do not appear to be aberrant conduct by individuals, but part of a conscious method of extracting information. If true, the planners of this process are at least as guilty as those who carried out the abuses. The President's legal counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, reportedly wrote in a memorandum that the decision to avoid invoking the Geneva Conventions, quote, preserves flexibility in the war on terrorism. Belittling or ignoring the Geneva Conventions invites our enemies to do the same and increases the danger to our military servicemen and women. It also sends a disturbing message to the world that America does not feel bound by internationally accepted standards of conduct. The findings of General Tacuba's report, as reported on a public website, raise a number of disturbing issues. For example, how far up the chain was there implicit or explicit direction or approval or knowledge of these prisoner abuses? Why was a joint interrogation and detention facility at Abu Ghraib established in a way which led to the subordination of the military police brigade to the military intelligence unit conducting interrogation activities? What was the role played by the military intelligence, the CIA, and any other intelligence units in requesting or suggesting abusive activities? And how is it in our nation's interest to have civilian contractors rather than military personnel performing vital national security functions such as prisoner interrogations in a war zone? When soldiers break the law or fail to follow orders, commanders can hold them accountable for their misconduct. Military commanders don't have the same authority over civilian contractors. And finally, Secretary Rumsfeld and General Myers, I join our chairman in expressing deep dismay that when you briefed senators in a classified session last week on events in Iraq, just hours before the story broke on television, you made no reference to the impending revelations. Executive branch consultation with Congress is not supposed to be an option, but a longstanding and fundamental responsibility. It is essential that our nation, at the highest levels, apologize directly to the victims and to the Iraqi people as a whole for these actions. But words alone are not sufficient. Prompt and decisive action, which establish responsibility and holds people accountable, is essential here. It will also, hopefully, convince the world that our free and open society does not condone and will not tolerate this depraved behavior.
I'll ask our witnesses to rise.
Listening to live coverage of Senate Armed Services Committee hearings, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, Joint Chiefs Chairman Richard